LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Die internationale Finanz, sie blieb brutal, rücksichtslos, sie presste unser Volk aus, soweit sie konnte. Die Staatsmänner der alliierten Nationen, sie blieben hartherzig. Im Gegenteil, man sagte damals ganz eiskalt, dass wir 20 Millionen Deutsche zu viel seien. 1939 haben nun diese Westmächte die Maske fallen lassen. Sie haben Deutschland die Kriegserklärungen geschickt. Trotz all unserer Versuche, trotz unserem Entgegenkommen. Sie geben es heute ganz ungeniert selber zu. Jawohl, Polen hätte wahrscheinlich eingewilligt, aber das wollten wir nicht. Sie geben es heute zu, dass es möglich gewesen wäre, leicht eine Verständigung herbeizuführen. Aber sie wollten das nicht. Sie wollten den Krieg. Guten! Das haben mir einst meine inneren Gegner auch gesagt. Ich habe den Aufruf die Hand gegeben. Sie haben sie zurückgestoßen. Sie schrien auch, nein, nicht Versöhnung, nicht Verständigung, sondern Kampf. Gut, sie haben den Kampf bekommen. Und ich kann Frankreich und England nur sagen, auch sie werden den Kampf bekommen.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. That's Legalize-Freedom.com, and you can spell Legalize with an S or a Z. You can also follow us on Twitter at LegalizeFreedom, spelt with an S, and on Facebook as LegalizeFreedom, a media, news and publishing page. We had around 100,000 listeners last month, five of whom put a tip in the tip jar, so if you'd like to help us bring those two numbers just a little bit closer together, you can do so by going to the donate page on the website. If you don't wish to use PayPal, and I can fully understand why, go to the About page, you'll find an email contact, drop me a line, and I'm sure we can sort something out. In the meantime, as always, I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Farsight Institute Director Courtney Brown, who joins us to discuss their latest project, Adolf Hitler, a remote viewing psychological profile of a mass murderer. The life, times, and crimes of Adolf Hitler and the Nazi regime need no introduction. During these remote viewing sessions, however, we venture beyond people, places, and events, and the boundaries of time and space, to probe the mind of Adolf Hitler, his fears, his motivations, his very thoughts. We then take the results as a launch point to discuss even more significant issues, involving quantum physics, consciousness, the dualities of mental and physical, suffering and redemption, love and hate, the existence of evil, and whether our often traumatic earthly experience of extreme separateness, division and polarity ultimately serves a purpose in the evolution of the universe itself.
Hello and welcome, Courtney, and thank you so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greg, it is really great to actually be on your show. I'm honored to be here, so thanks again for inviting me.
Now, Courtney, today, as always, we're here to talk about the Farsight Institute's latest project. In the interests of time, I would suggest that we refer listeners who want to know about remote viewing to some of our earlier interviews where we go into a full explanation of it. They can go to legalize-freedom.com. They can go to the search bar top right. They can put in remote viewing. They can put in your name, Courtney Brown. They can put in the Farsight Institute, your organization. They can search, they'll find it all there. If they're on the interview page for this show, they'll find all the links to our previous talks, or they can go to the word cloud on the right and click on Courtney Brown or any of those other terms. If people are listening to this on YouTube, I would refer them to all of what I've just said. So in the interest, as I say, of getting into the meat of the issue, we'll let people find out about remote viewing itself that way. The latest Farsight project is dramatic even by your standards. It's entitled Adolf Hitler, a Remote Viewing Psychological Profile of a Mass Murderer. Now, you guys said you were going to be busy in 2016, and certainly you've kept to that because, you know, you've certainly hit the ground running. Tell us about this latest project. Just give us the overview, because this isn't just the story of Hitler or the Nazis or the Holocaust. That's pretty well documented. This is something else entirely.
Yeah, this is interesting because, as you know, we have been coming out with these projects at the Farsight Institute for a large number of years now, and we have really documented that it is possible for really well-trained individuals to use these U.S. military-derived procedures to describe events, places, times, people across time and space. We also have known that we can use these same procedures to pick up thoughts, the general tenor of thoughts, often not the specific thoughts, but the tenor of thoughts, the emotions that people have across time and space, past, present, and future, with some challenges with regard to the future, but clearly with past and present, we actually do understand how to do it with the future under a certain experimental design. But with regard to the past and present, it's much more easy without that experimental design. And this, we had done projects ranging, we know our projects in the past, interviews from the origin of the Great Pyramid of Giza to the 9/11 events, to remote viewing aliens, Cydonia, Iapetus, Phoenix Lights, and then the JFK assassination. And we've done so many different projects, and we knew we could do that. And I said to myself, you know, we're always looking for challenges. Now, the remote viewing has to be done blind, totally blind. So the remote viewers have no idea what they're going to be remote viewing. They only get a non-leading email saying there was a target, and that's it. And then they send me their stuff. So I'm the one who's responsible for designing these targets. That's my job at the Institute. And so I had the situation of saying, well, we have already done plenty of examples for people to see regarding high-level, big-profile targets, projects across, we're transferring and resolving mysteries, transferring information across time and space, perceptual information. So I was looking for a challenge. I was looking for something different. We always push the boundaries. We always are trying new things at the Institute. So I said, do we describe people, places, events again? Or will we do something different? Now, in this particular case, I said, well, let's merge the two ideas of describing emotions, thoughts, and feelings together with the idea of remote viewing physical places, events, people, and come up with a new idea, a new concept, a new way of using remote viewing, something that we hadn't done before. So I said, okay, let's do something really different. Let's have these remote viewers mentally perceive and perfectly describe a famous individual, and then to go into the mind of that individual at the time that that individual is thinking some well-known thought, and have the remote viewers trace the origin of that thought, where that thought came from. And then it would be the first part of it would be clearly verifiable. So it had to be a very high profile event that there's documented evidence it happened, and all the physical details have to be there. And then into the thoughts into the mind of that person and tracing back in time what made that person think that thought. Well, that had to be something that would make sense so that the analyst, in this case be myself, would understand it. And so the thought can't just be any random thought. It has to be something that's very pointed. So it's, I have long wondered about Hitler, Adolf Hitler. Why did he hate certain groups so much? Why did he in particular focus on Jews and then also Gypsies and Slavs? But in particular, why did he focus on these groups? And so there was a famous speech that Hitler made on January 30th, 1939, where he said, and I'll make the English translation here, if international finance Jewry in and outside Europe should succeed in once again plunging the nations into a world war, then the result will not be the victory of Jewry, but rather the annihilation of the Jewish race in Europe. Now, he did this in the Reichstag, and that's not the Reichstag building, because the Reichstag building was burned and severely damaged under extremely suspicious circumstances in 1933. This was done in the Kroll Opera House, which is where the Reichstag met after the burning of the Reichstag building. And it's a very ornate building with lots of arches in the front of it. And it's, you know, very fancy inside with when the men of the Reichstag were meeting in it. And for that particular speech, we have a video that shows Hitler actually making that exact sentence, that exact speech. So that was that was a very pointed idea. So here we have a situation where we have a famous person making a very clear speech with a very clear intent, in a very notable building that has got lots of stuff to describe on the inside, with a certain group of people, with the men of the Reichstag in it. So that gave us tons of verifiable stuff. Plus, we have this video of him making that speech. So that was a very good idea for a physical target. And now the idea of going into the mind of Hitler at the time and tracing back where he has this hatred, how he got this hatred, why he picked certain groups and then want to kill them. So that was a very pointed thought. So if it was just like a thought of, well, hey, I think I'm going to go out and get a hamburger for lunch, that's not a pointed enough thought to come up with a clear reason for why someone would want to have a hamburger for lunch. But the idea of identifying a particular ethnic group and religious group and then wanting their annihilation, that's a powerful thought. And that is going to have an origin someplace. So like, why is he feeling this way? Why all this vitriolic hatred? So that was a thought that would likely lead the remote viewers back to some specific point in time where I would be able to look at the data and understand why he had those types of feelings. So that seemed to me to be a perfect experiment. So, mind you, this was an experiment because we have used remote viewing plenty of times under totally squeaky clean scientific conditions, always totally blind. The viewers know nothing, and the viewers are on opposite ends of the planet. We have Dick Elgeier in Hawaii and Daz Smith in the UK, and they don't communicate at all during the remote viewing process. So it's really very well done, and all of the remote viewing is recorded live on video, so this is not them recalling what they did privately. You get to see it live. That was a perfect condition for this type of experiment. You have the best remote viewers on the planet, perfect scientific conditions, and they had to find Hitler all by themselves. They were never told anything. And they did. They found the guy, and they found the guy giving a talk, and they described it perfectly of him giving this type of talk. And because of the design of the target, which they knew nothing about, they were drawn into his mind and ended up someplace else. And they then described where that someplace else, what was there. And I got two different perspectives. Both Des and Dick gave sort of different, every viewer when they go into a target, they get the verifiable stuff, but they also add their own element to it. So both Des and Dick added an element to it that was really complementary from my perspective. So from Des, we got the perspective of sort of looking at Hitler the way a psychoanalyst would look at Hitler, tracing back the origin of a thought to come up with why he has this psychosis. And then with Dick, he seems to have gone back further in time to Hitler before he was Hitler, meaning people repeat themselves, not just in their life, but before they were there and after they were there. So we got sort of a bigger perspective, and it was honestly one of the most fascinating projects we've ever done. In my humble opinion, I really do think we have done some interesting stuff, but this is my favorite. This is my absolute favorite, because it was so complicated to pull this off. And we could only have done it now after working with these viewers for so many years. This is the time when we could actually do something like this. And wow, did we get a result that knocked my socks off.
What was your previous experience, whether personal or of other remote viewers, of probing thoughts as opposed to people, places, and events?
Well, we have had lots of experiences of people probing the minds of target individuals. And they do get the general tenor of thoughts. We knew that could be done. But we have never done that with the intent of tracing where a thought came from. That's the difference. That's the different thing. So we could have, in fact, they did actually go into the mind of Hitler at the time he was giving that. And they got all of the emotions, of the passions, all of the general tenor of the thoughts. But the difference was, the new thing was, something that we had never done, is to go into the mind and trace it back to where the thought came from. That was really new. And we do that. We do that kind of thing. We try new things we never did it before. And now we know it can be done. And, you see, it's very important to, if you're going to do something new, you have to pick a target that you could understand the results from. And it has to be a very specific thought with a lot of power in it, a lot of intent, and so that when you see the result, when you see the origin of that thought, it has to be some element that would make sense in understanding that thought. And so most thoughts that people have don't really have an origin that's sufficiently powerful to make remote viewing work the way it can work. You have to have a thought that has a big enough bang to the buck so that when you get the results, it sort of makes sense. Most thoughts they don't really have that strong an origin point. We have too many sort of random thoughts. Has to be something really powerful, really big. And this thought, this fit it. And of course, we always have to have verifiable parts of it. 50% of all of our projects, 50% of all targets used in all projects, meaning all projects we have to have at least 50% of what the remote viewers perceive being totally verifiable. So we do not do projects that cannot be verified. At least 50% of the data have to be totally verifiable for every single project. So what really made this was the choice was we had the speech. It had a lot of passion associated with it. Was just not a random idle thought. It had awful consequences. The guy was actually going to do in the future what he said he was going to do, which is the annihilation of the Jewish race. So that was a big thought, and it had a huge historical implication because of the Holocaust. And so that was something that not only interested me, but we thought we could do it. I thought we could pull this off with that particular thought and that particular individual. But I wasn't expecting results as powerful as what we got. But they made sense. I just wasn't expecting quite the level of power that we got.
Well, Courtney, the thing about thought, and this is just a general thought about thought, is that people sometimes can be dismissive of thoughts. As you say, most of us spend a lot of time having random thoughts about what we want for lunch, as you mentioned, yada, yada, yada. But thought is at the core of, like, magic, for example, you know, in terms of focused intent, you know, repeated thought, focused, concentrated thought, deliberate thought. And also, a thought is behind everything that exists, and people quite often don't consider that. You know, we're speaking across the internet. Someone had a thought about what that could be. The software that we're using, someone thought about that. So, you know, it's very powerful. As you said, there's a range of thought, of course, from, you know, completely dismissible through to something that does become a thing, good or bad. But, this is the whole project really reminded me about, not only from a remote viewing point of view, the irrelevance in some ways of time and space, but also the spectrum between the mental and the physical, and how that actually is that blurs. It isn't just black and white.
Yeah, totally. It's if you don't mind me just mentioning a bit, just, you know, a 30-second thumbnail of why this is relevant with respect to science itself. All of everything that we see is, of course, large, big stuff, physical bodies, planets, computers, desks, cars, houses. But all of that stuff is made up of quantum stuff, molecules, atoms, subatomic particles, and so on. Well, no physicist has ever, in the history of all of physics, has ever found anything solid. There is nothing solid in the universe. They have never found a billiard ball type solid particle. Inside all of our solid stuff, or apparently solid stuff, we have just molecules. Inside the molecules, and molecules in empty space. Inside the molecules, atoms in empty space. Inside the atoms, subatomic particles in empty space. But they've never found a particle that is solid, that doesn't, like a billiard ball. It just doesn't exist. The only thing they found is energy. Energy, frequencies, waves, things like that. And so, when we think about the quantum stuff, we're all built up on the quantum stuff, we have to remember what John Wheeler, the famous physicist, once said, that nothing really happens on the quantum level unless it's observed in some way, unless it's somehow it's registered or something. And Einstein used to mock his quantum mechanical colleagues by saying, do you really think the moon wouldn't be there if I didn't look at it? But in a very real sense, there's a lot of different ways to register something, indirectly, directly, but somehow thought actually causes things to manifest. And in the absence of somebody somehow thinking and observing something, it doesn't pop into that reality. Now, physicists have never wrapped their heads around that and completely understood it, although we do understand how that works now. But in generally speaking, it's been one of the biggest mysteries in all of science. And so what you see is the interaction between thought and physical reality, that thought makes physical reality manifest in some way. Well, really what's actually happening, and the physics behind it really made their biggest leap with Hugh Everett in 1957, but it's finally now being just beginning to be accepted by mainstream physicists. About 18% of mainstream physicists now accept his so-called other worlds interpretation of physical reality, of the quantum mechanical experiment, of the so-called two slits experiment, which we now understand is the basis for physical reality as we see it. So that thoughts indeed interact with energy, and they act as a form of, like an artist would mold clay. And so when thoughts observe things, those thoughts pop into the reality of that person. Now, that means that the thoughts are actually molding and creating and forming the energy into the physical things that we see and hear. Now, it doesn't mean that those physical things don't already exist. It means that for that person, the thoughts actually connect that person with that thing. So that for that person, it seems to pop in. But really what's happening is that person's thought is tuning in to that reality that's defined through energy. And so what you get is a physical reality that's very much like a hologram, that's very much like a picture on a television set. And probably in about 10 years, most televisions will be projecting into living rooms as holograms, and they'll look completely realistic. So, you know, it's sort of like that, what we live in. And so when we talk about thoughts, we're really talking about the very creative energy that makes physical reality manifest. So, you know, you can have energy, but thoughts are what make it happen to look like physical reality looks. And so it's a very fascinating thing, but we are beginning to understand the physics of it. Again, I do not do any of this at my university where I'm a professor, but I do not do any remote viewing research there. But I nonetheless am a mathematician. So I works in a social science program, but I'm a mathematician. So I understand the mathematics of quantum mechanics and relativistic physics and the changes that are happening mathematically. But it's never been a question of math. It's never been something where people questioned how the calculations are done. It's always been the interpretation of the quantum mechanical phenomena. And now we are understanding a more accurate description of the interpretation. And we're beginning to understand how these thoughts match with physical reality. So that's why we could trace a thought back in time, because thoughts are the very things that create that reality. So it's sort of following a frequency back.
Well, as you mentioned on this Adolf Hitler project, you've got your familiar duo of Daz Smith, Dick Allgaier. And Daz is up first this time round. And one key thing that he taps into quite early on when he's trying to search out this individual is that he gets a sense that he doesn't like this individual, but he then concedes, but this person can be quite amenable. So in there, there's the seeds of something that begins to emerge, a pattern that emerges throughout the project. Yeah. And it's kind of a person with two sides. And this picture that eventually takes shape is actually split personality. In fact, it's borderline schizophrenic. And there's something in that, I think, that's very important.
Well, actually, there's two elements here that you would be very interested in. The first is that I was actually very concerned in the middle of this project that Daz Smith would quit because he did not like this personality. He didn't know it was Hitler, but he was quite disturbed by this person. So this guy had a lot of passion. He was very shady. He was not a friendly guy, and it really disturbed him. So I was concerned that he might drop off the project in the middle just because the person with the target was so target person was so unpleasant to him. But I kept telling him, Daz, just finish it up. You're doing fine. Just keep going. And I held my breath. And Daz is the trooper. He knows how to do this. And so he did it. He finished it professionally. So he wasn't threatening to quit, but he was mentioning to me in emails that he didn't like this person that was in this target. And again, I never told him anything about the person, but he just was relating his remote viewing experiences and was sort of upset that I sort of upset that the I gave him that as a target. Anyway, so I was concerned about that. But then when he went back in time to the origin of the thought, this idea of mental illness was not ambiguous in the slightest. Daz very clearly said, this person has schizophrenia. He's mentally ill. And he has a dual personality where at times he can be very amenable, very friendly, and at other times he's like, watch out. And he traced it back to the physical abuse that he experienced as a young person. So when he was a child, we do know that Hitler, discovered by or related by an analysis that was done for the U.S. military by the predecessor of the CIA. This is right before the war, that Adolf Hitler was in fact beaten by his father, who was a sadist. And Adolf Hitler was beaten almost daily with lashes, with a stick, sometimes up to 32 lashes in a beating. And this went on and on and on. And Hitler loved his mother, hated his father, but loved his mother, and was probably very upset with his mother that she was not able to protect him from his father. So that physical abuse, it may have actually included either sexual abuse or physical abuse that had a sexual consequence. And that was a fundamental component of his psychology in making him schizophrenic and making him have this illness, which led him, of course, to being a person that picked out groups and wanted to eliminate those groups. So the psychological analysis we get essentially from Daza's work is that Hitler is someone who wanted to control his environment so that it wouldn't hurt him, because his environment hurt him in the past. And he had enemies in early parts of his life. His enemy was his father. So he had enemies, and his solution for these enemies, of course, he saw the world as having enemies, and these enemies had to be removed. Just like he wished that his mother could have removed his father when the world had troubles, that was Hitler's solution, remove the enemies. So he had a penchant for targeting enemies, finding enemies, and then wanting them removed. That was the element that we got from Daza's session that was really interesting. At least from my perspective, it was absolutely fascinating. So, and then it did match up with the psychoanalysis that was gotten, or actually you can call it that, the psychoanalysis that was gotten by the U.S. military right before the war.
And also in his early life, it seems that he was affected deeply by the death of his younger brother, Edmund. He seems to have really changed after that. You know, maybe that was someone that was there for him. You know, someone that really a part of his life that made the rest of it harder to deal with when he was gone. And of course, people famously will know that Hitler was an artist, and quite an accomplished artist actually. And that was suppressed because at one point in his life, he wanted to be an artist. And the picture emerges here of not just of the abuse, but also of the suppression of urges, you know, of directions that he wanted to go in, as it were. And that they've got a saying, you know, the oppressed always hit down. And this is just a classic case of what you describe of, it's such a cliche, isn't it, really, in a way, you know, but the bullied kid taking it out on the rest of the world, but just on a scale unimagined. In later life, Hitler exhibited some behaviors, or many, of course, beyond his psychosis and, you know, his activities in the political realm, that could be traced perhaps directly back to childhood abuse. I mean, for example, he was a drug user. He used amphetamines, methamphetamine, cocaine. And in fact, as I understand it, from about 1942 onward, was addicted to amphetamines. And that affects your thinking no end. And also, Daz, in his session, he stumbled upon an issue about perhaps hidden illness. Was this person concealing something that was really wrong with them? And when you look into it, and again, this is documented, but Daz wouldn't have known this, that various researchers have indicated that it seems that Hitler suffered from irritable bowel syndrome, possibly irregular heartbeat, coronary sclerosis, syphilis even, and perhaps even Parkinson's disease. So even if it was any one of those, would be serious.
Actually, you just hit the list of diseases that he supposedly had. Daz did a really great job describing all sorts of verifiable stuff. Now, the psychological stuff that he described, the schizophrenia, the mental illness, the physical abuse, that was all documented by Dr. Henry A. Murray. Now, he was the director of the Harvard Psychological Clinic, and he was requested to do that during World War II by the Office, American Office of Strategic Services, which is a predecessor of the CIA. And he's the one, Dr. Murray, from Harvard, who he was the one who documented the regular beatings that Hitler got with lashes, sometimes 32 with lashes with each instance, regular, almost daily beatings, that the mental illness, the schizophrenia, all that stuff was coming out from there. So there was a lot of verifiable stuff that we were really expecting for this target. Because I knew that the verifiable stuff would include the building, the inside and outside of the building, Hitler himself giving the speech, the environment, all the people, the very noisy audience, everybody, mostly men, formally dressed in the Reichstag and the Kroll Opera House. So all that was verifiable, but I didn't know that Daz would also pick up the now verifiable psychological state of Hitler as documented by Dr. Henry A. Murray from Harvard. And so, and the physical abuse, which either included sexual stuff or had a sexual implication or repercussion. And then Daz also picked up the physical illness as well, which you listed a nice tidy list of all that stuff, including potentially syphilis, Parkinson's disease, a whole list of stuff. And of course, the medications that Hitler was taking at that time would not be the choice medications of today, but they were the medications that were available at that time. And they included pain medication as well as, you know, rather at that time, what was considered treatment medication for some of those illnesses. So yeah, Daz picked up a ton of verifiable stuff. Again, I was thinking the verifiable stuff was going to be limited to the physical building, Hitler giving the speech, the men of the Reichstag, the general environment, because he had a video of all that. We could compare the data with the actual physical stuff. But I was really very pleased to see all the other stuff, the illness stuff, both psychological and physical illness stuff that we now have verification for, to also be picked up by Daz. So Daz did a really, really great job.
When we get into Dick's session, some other stuff begins to emerge again when he's beginning to perceive this personality, and these issues of duality come up again. He says, this guy appears to be at once powerful and yet powerless, and fearless and yet afraid. He's physically unimpressive, and yet, you know, many people have attested to that, people who met Hitler, and yet he gives this incredibly powerful oratory. And all of this speaks to, again, a frightened little boy lashing out, you know, once he's in a position of actual power and control.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly correct. So Dick actually picked up all of that current state psychology of that combination, just exactly as you described. And, mind you, I want to remind your listeners that this is all recorded, remote viewing recorded live. So you can actually see Daz and Dick sort through these perceptions and describe these things in incredible detail. Dick did an amazing job describing the interior of the Reichstag. So when he describes the stage where Hitler was standing, where he was giving the speech, that he described the audience, that was a very noisy audience. He clearly says, these people are buying what that guy's selling. It was a stunning description of the interior of the Reichstag. So you get to see that type of remote viewing of physical stuff really well. But on the other hand, when Dick went into the mind of Hitler, he was attracted to another element that we really needed. See, there's a lot of people who have physical abuse from that often is sexual or has sexual connotations. But that doesn't turn them into mass murderers. That doesn't turn them into a person who identifies certain groups and then systematically goes out and tries to kill those groups, mobilizing a whole nation. So that the elements that Daz picked up needed to be had for the puzzle to be solved, but that wasn't enough. We needed to know the other side. So this is very typical of how remote viewers work in coordination. And that's why we use typically more than one remote viewer for projects, because they pick up on other things. So what Dick apparently went after is he perceived what, now this has to be interpreted because these are just perceptions that Dick has. And then, but these perceptions are designed by the nature of the remote viewing process to answer my informational needs as the analyst and tasker for the project. And so I needed to know, in addition to what set Hitler up as a child to be the guy he was when he was adult, I had to know also what we were dealing with going into the life of Hitler. So apparently that's what Dick got, which is to go back in time before Hitler was Hitler. Who was he? And he perceived Hitler, the personality, the being, before he was a physical being, and he perceived him as a different type of a guy. He described him as almost like a ghoulish, almost like a gargoyle that you see on the outside of certain churches to protect from evil spirits, to protect the church from evil spirits. But the point is, it was like he had these almost glowing eyes. It was a very creepy thing. Anyway, he saw this person, clearly described him. The guy was not human, meaning he was humanoid in the sense that he had two eyes and a face, but he was not human. So that indicates that this person was in some existence prior to being Hitler, somewhere else, not on Earth. The interesting thing about it is that the guy was clearly an extraterrestrial of some type, because he saw Dick immediately. We have lots of experience with remote viewing because of whatever it is that's set up, the DNA of humans. Humans just cannot perceive when someone is remote viewing them. It just doesn't happen. And some extraterrestrials, however, we have had the experience that they can do that. So this guy immediately saw Dick, and he snarled at Dick, meaning he was not happy. This is a very powerful person, a very mean-spirited person, a very powerful personality. And then Dick didn't hang around with that person more than just a few seconds, and then immediately morphed out to, you might say, that which his higher mind knew we needed to see in order to understand this being. And then he went and saw skeletons in caskets and mass graveyards. So I have to then be able to interpret this, and I have to be able to make sense out of what this is. So as I put it together, and this is, you can call this speculative, but as it makes sense to me, meaning before Hitler was Hitler, he was a powerful person somewhere else. Meaning, you don't get to be a powerful person like Hitler out of the blue. I mean, he wasn't a chipmunk before he was Hitler. I mean, he was somebody who can mobilize an entire nation to kill upwards of 11 million people and set that whole nation in a war setting. I mean, that's just not your average babysitter. That's a special type of person that does that. And apparently that person was an extraterrestrial who was able to recognize Dick immediately and who was involved with mass killing before. Meaning, in addition to that person, that being, Dick immediately saw like the killing fields, the mass graves. That tells me that that person and mass death are connected. So as I interpret these data, I see this as an example of us tracing a person back to before he was this person on Earth. And this person was undoubtedly a very highly controlling person who like to control the environment. And when the environment didn't go the way that person was wanting it to go, his solution was to eliminate those elements that were outside of his desired outcome. So getting rid of people was apparently a method of control that was used by this individual. Take that individual, put him in a human body, let him live the childhood life of Hitler, of being physically abused by a sadistic father, who, and then developing a mental illness, which probably reflected a level of mental illness that this being had before he was Hitler, when he was an extraterrestrial someplace. So, you know, that was a perfect combination. You have a setup of that type of personality who has a history of eliminating people that are don't do what they're supposed to do. And you put that in a situation of a being Hitler who was deeply hurt as a young person by an evil father, and Hitler being unable to eliminate that person. Then when Hitler gets older, that's all that you need. You have a very powerful personality who finds the solution to the problems in life as getting rid of people who hurt him. And when he sees other people being hurt, like his nation was going through a very severe economic downturn, of course, as a result of the Great Depression. And when he sees other problems with the country, he immediately assigns enemies to it, that certain people are doing this. And so that's where he picks a group. I don't know if it was a random choice or it was a choice. There was a lot of anti-Semitism in Germany before Hitler came around. So maybe that was sort of a natural target for him to identify. So, you know, but the idea of the Aryan race, if you think about that, the whole idea of an Aryan race seems to suggest that Hitler likes the idea of everybody being the same. And if everybody was the same, they're all not going to cause each other problems. There'll be no trouble if everyone's the same. And so if everyone has the same racial characteristics, you don't get hurt. And that's how he identified it. And so he looked around Germany and he saw groups that were different: Gypsies, Slavs, Jews. And his solution was something that he experienced before he was Hitler back in the old days. I sort of think of him as like a Darth Vader type personality who, you know, had no problems with eliminating large numbers of people in order to get uniformity, that type of control. I sort of look at the universe, I look at actually earthly life as dominated by polarities. So you have people who like the lack of control, the flower children of the Greenwich Village during the 1960s sort of typifies that type of idea. And then you like people who like maximum control. And Hitler was on the side of maximum control. And, you know, that's what happens when you get this struggle between polarities.
Overall, as Dick's session progressed, I began to think more and more about ideas of interdimensional entities, particularly when, you know, he perceives this demonic figure that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, he called it a demon.
Yeah, and then ideas of, like, you know, the jinn and whatever you want to call it, but just that whatever it is that lies beyond our five sense reality, and whether there was something, some connection there. And that led me then further down the thought avenue into the idea of evil itself. You know, does evil exist? You know, whether it has a purpose, a function in the universe or not. And that's where I ended up, because I thought, well, this is a almost like a pure manifestation of evil in some ways.
You know, that's very profound. That's exactly the way I think of it. I actually don't know if we can say that evil exists. What we seem to have is polarity, extremes on one side or the other. And I think from the perspective of one polarity, one polarized side, the other side looks evil. So from the perspective of Hitler, I'm sure he saw the groups that he was identifying as being evil, as being the cause of the problems of society. And from the other side, looking at Hitler as being on the polar opposite of them, they saw Hitler as being evil. So, you know, the issue of whether there actually is evil, I think, resolves down to the level of polarity that exists in a society, where you have on one side a huge desire to control, and through any means possible, including killing people, eliminating them. And on the other side, the issue to have freedom from control. And I see this happening everywhere on the planet as a condition of human existence. So whether you're looking in Africa or Asia or Europe or the United States or Latin America, no matter where you look, you see the struggle between people who control and people who want to become free of that control. And both sides look at the opposite side of that polarity as being evil. And, you know, if I was to say, is there a solution? I'd sort of say, well, the solution actually can't be an outcome, an ending thing, because this whole thing seems to be a process. It seems to be that we are here on Earth to experience that level of polarity, to that level of separateness. And with that level of separateness, we then have to struggle through it to come back together so that we have no polarized existence, but sort of a unitary existence, but with the experience of having gone through that period of polarization. That's how I sort of look at it. I always look at things as a process, and that any one snapshot at time is not the end reality, but you have to look at the whole thing. For example, if you were to look at the Hitler personality himself, before he was Hitler, you might have characterized him as sort of a Darth Vader evil type of personality. He was involved in the killing fields. I mean, he certainly looked like scary. I mean, Dick even called him a demon. But on the other hand, would it be appropriate to judge Hitler because as a being? Because if that being continues to evolve, as I'm assuming that being will, what will eventually be the result of that being? Will that being become so degraded that he will eventually have to be imprisoned until he just fades away into the network of the, you know, the spiritual whatever of the universe? Or will that person evolve to grow out of that extreme level of polarization that he felt? And the bottom line is, if you're to be a good person, can you really be a good person if you haven't experienced being a bad person? So can you actually be a really great, huge help to the universe if you haven't personally experienced what it's like to be a really evil person that has hurt the universe? So I'm sort of in a situation of saying, I don't know the answer to that question, and I don't want to get into the business of judging, you know, Hitler as an infinite being that would evolve out of the Hitler personality, because maybe Hitler's future is to contribute to the universe in a way that very few could contribute, someone who has experienced firsthand being evil, as we would say. He would have experienced killing, mass killing, torturing, kidnapping, hurting. Maybe at some future point in time, that will be an element in a future version of that personality, where he will be able to help convey to others what the consequences of being that kind of evil is all about. And other people would never have gone through that. So you never really can judge. So at that point, if you look at Hitler, let's say he does evolve into being a good person, in some future after death, whatever. Well, where do we judge him? Do we judge him when he was Hitler on Earth, when we would say he was the worst of the worst? Or do we judge him at some future time when he evolves out of that and tries to teach others through his personal experience what it was like to be evil so that they don't do that? So, you know, I just don't know. So the question is, what is evil? How would you get a good thing if you don't also have a bad thing? The Hitler that we know was clearly a bad thing. But where would we be as a society? Now, you know, the other side of this is that nobody ever really dies. That's clear from the remote viewing experience, because with the remote viewing experience, clearly the perceptions of the remote viewers are not limited to their physical bodies, because they are able to experience across time and space. So obviously some element of themselves is probably the primary element, is not physical. And so when the remote viewers die, that element does obviously still exist, because it already exists across time and space. So that moment when the body dies will not affect that element, because that element is already all over the place. So all those people, according to these results, all those people who died and were tortured and killed and all the horrors that happened during the Holocaust, 11 to 20 million people, as bad as it was, they still exist. We can go back in time and remote view them. So, and that means after they died, they are still here. So they still exist in some way. So the real question is, they experienced, the victims experienced polarity from the other side of it. So Hitler and the SS, the Nazis, they experienced polarity from the perspective of the perpetrators, the predators. They experienced polarity from the people, from the side of people who wanted to exert that control over others. The victims, on the other hand, the Jews, the Gypsies, the Slavs, so on, the 11 plus million people who died during the Holocaust, they experienced that polarity from the other side, from the victim's side. So if we talked about Hitler on one side, how do we talk about the victims? Was it something that those people should not have experienced? Well, certainly when you look back at the Holocaust, you'd say, that's awful, that should never happen. But in a universe that evolves, how do you know something should never happen unless it's actually happened? So in the far future, I can see that the victims of the Holocaust, those people who were killed during the Holocaust, in their future lives, in their future existence as they grow up throughout the universe and help guide others, they will be able to explain to others what it was like to be, that experience, that level of pain, that level of hardship, that level of death, that level of starvation, that level of all of the troubles that happened during the Holocaust. They'll be able to explain that. And nobody could understand it unless they actually went through it. So, you know, this whole question of how do you judge something? Do you judge it at the moment it happens, or do you judge it from the consequences of how the universe turns out 100,000, a million, a billion years from now?
Yeah, I mean, I've had similar conversations like this with other guests, and I've then had listeners respond, not a high percentage, but certain listeners responded with, oh, you know, this is outrageous, this is completely unacceptable, you're telling me that these people chose to, you know, but that's grounded very much in five-sense reality, in this whatever holographic, you know, simulation, whatever we want to put it, that we find ourselves in. But if you look at it from the perspective more or less of what I think you're talking about and what other people I've spoken with were talking about, which is the evolution of, for want of a better word, consciousness, then it does change it. Now, nobody's saying that on some raw physical level, that if the five sense reality is all there is, that suffering is something we should be jumping up and down and celebrating. That's not what's being said here. It's just, we're just talking about something bigger and trying to speculate about a wider purpose, what that might be. And in that context, what purpose is suffering and indeed the, you know, and indeed love, you know, may serve.
Actually, that's the ultimate point. If love is the answer, how do you learn to love? That's the question. Can you learn to love if you do not know the consequences of not loving? That's a real serious. Can, for example, you can, how many people have seen a situation, just about everybody's seen a situation, where you run across someone who has a very shallow experience in life, always being pampered, always being cared for, and one of the consequences of that seems to be that that person's emotional depth is not very great, and you wonder if they actually really love anybody. On the other hand, you see people who have really suffered in life in some way, either by causing problems, by causing pain, and then regretting it later, or by experiencing pain, by being the victim. And you look at them far later, and you really see them sometimes reaching out to understand, you know, a greater meaning in life and to understand love in some way. So there is, you know, that real question of what is love is a big issue, but I don't think it's an easy route. I don't think you get to love just by walking straight into it. I think it's a crooked path where you look at both sides of polarity. However, I do want to mention one thing, Greg, I think is very important. I'm a mathematician, and all aspects of everything have a distribution, meaning there is no such thing as a one-thing deal that there is no distribution about. Everything on the quantum level has a distribution, and everything on a physical level has a distribution. There's no one single blade of grass. There's only a lawn with many blades of grass, and those the lawn with many blades of grass has a distribution in terms of how high, how tall each blade of grass is. So if you look at the Hitler personality and the Holocaust as being arguably the worst of the worst that's ever happened on Earth, and say that anything you see has got a distribution, that means if you expand the sample size to not just be the worst of the worst on Earth, but the worst of the worst on other planets as well. So you have a sample of, say, a million planets with people on them, or with living beings, of sentient beings of some type. Then the only thing you can say from a scientific perspective is, if you have a sample, then the only thing you can say is to predict what kind of thing exists out there, is to say the mean. And so if you have a sample of one, which is Earth, human history, and you have an incident, a situation where you see it as something happened which you consider to be the worst of the worst, Hitler and the Holocaust, since that's a sample of one, the only thing you can make an assumption about is that that must be a mean, that must be an average. So if you have, say, 2,000 other planets with populations of some sort on them, given your sample of one, if you're to predict what it's like, then the only thing you can say is, if you were to look at the worst of the worst situations that happen on other planets, that Hitler and the Holocaust will be a mean, an average, meaning there will be situations in which the worst case situation for a particular planet will be much better than what happened with Hitler and the Holocaust. And there will be other situations where what happened with Hitler and the Holocaust, if you compare it, would be much worse. So from a scientific perspective, what we can get from the Hitler and the Holocaust experience on Earth is that it's been worse elsewhere, meaning on other planets somewhere, there are other places, someplace where more people have died, there's been more killing, the torture has been worse than even what we experienced, meaning everything has a distribution. So what we should learn about this is from the Hitler experience and from the Holocaust experience is that this type of thing is possible, that we can do this to ourselves as humans. And what we should also learn from it as well is that this type of thing is also possible elsewhere. So from this learning, from this understanding, we thus should be driven to understand how this should not happen. What is the ultimate cause of this thing happening? It's naive to say it's just an evil person and get rid of the evil person and you have good things happen. You have to say, what drove the society to have this type of thing happen? And then you have to assume that what happened with Hitler could have been worse, and it probably has been much worse in other situations on other planets. Let me give you an example of how it could have been easily worse. If you're looking for a silver lining on something as horrible as Hitler and the Holocaust, this is it. We were blessed by the fact that it happened before the technological explosion occurred on this planet. Meaning, in the mid-1940s, you were still dealing with gunpowder, crude ways of flying machines, use of gasoline to move tanks and things like that. Imagine what it would happen if the Hitler and the Holocaust happened now, at the time when we have atomic weaponry, laser beams, we have stealth fighters. Now, imagine if the Hitler and the Holocaust experience happened 100 years in the future now, or 1,000 years in the future, or 10,000. So if you have that type of thing being possible, a Hitler and the Holocaust type of thing, and you place it in the future of us, you wouldn't be talking about 11 to 20 million people dying. You'd be talking about the possible annihilation of the entire species, the entire killing of everybody. You're talking about way more death. And so when I think of sort of like a Darth Vader personality on some other planet, I can see a situation where a whole planet was destroyed. I can see a situation where the level of oppression, the level of torture, the level of pain, suffering involved billions, not just 11 to 20 million people. So if we look at the Hitler experience from that wider angle perspective, it helps us wake up as a species. As bad as it was, the lesson to be learned is we can do this to each other. I think if there's one thing that is a mistake in the way that the whole Hitler and Holocaust experience is taught today, is it's by identifying it as something that those people over there did to those other people over there. It makes it separate from us. It's like the Germans did it to the Jews. It's separate, like it's not us. The reality is, last I heard, the Germans and Hitler were humans. And you and I are humans, Greg. And the Jews, last I heard, they're humans too. So we had humans being able to do that to other humans. And that means, if you interpret it, it wasn't those Germans over there that did it to those Jews over there. It was me and you. We did it to our other fellow humans. And from the victim's perspective, it didn't happen to those Jews. It happened to us. We humans. And so if you eliminate the Jew-German orientation of teaching the Holocaust and replace it with human against human, then you realize it wasn't Germans and Hitler that did it, but it was all of us. We did it. You and I did it.
Yeah, because the German border was arbitrary and floating. Yeah. It changed. What makes a Jew is it a racial thing? Is it a religious thing? Do you know what I mean? It's fluid up to a point. And I think that the compulsion for control comes from fear, generally yes. speaking. I see a lot of fear in our politicians these days and in other, military types and what have you. And that the fear generally is of the other, as you say, which isn't really the other at all.
It's that type of polarized thinking. For example, we have presidential candidates saying that group, like say Muslims, they're the enemy. We need to make sure they don't get into this country or we can need to expel them. You have groups, one group versus another group. It's that type of thinking. And then if you eliminate the element of what group they're in and you realize this is human versus human, then you say, well, what causes this level of polarization where one group looks at another group as an enemy? And so what causes, for example, I was looking at the Trevor Noah Daily Show on Comedy Central the other day, and he was asking a guest who was an activist for the Islamic community and saying, well, you know, how do you respond to the idea that all Muslims are not terrorists, but all terrorists are Muslim? And then she then had to talk around that problem. So, I mean, about that issue. And so when you look at that, you say, well, let's put ourselves in the position of ISIS, for example. Well, what causes ISIS to look at the world that way? ISIS is sort of like a Hitlerian way of thinking, meaning there is an enemy out there, the world, the Western world, and you have to control them and destroy them. And how they act to their own population is very much sort of like a Hitlerian type of thing with a lot of control. And if you deviate from that control, the head gets chopped off. I mean, it's that strong level of control. So what you see is a sort of human phenomenon is this polarized thinking of us versus them. And you have to say, what causes that to happen in the human psychology? And then the only way, of course, to resolve this is to diminish that level of polarization. As long as you have polarized thinking, you are going to have a us versus them mentality, and you're going to have people saying that group is the enemy, and if they are destroyed, we will be okay. And then you'll get terrorism, you'll get Holocaust, you'll get mass death, you'll get all the stuff that we saw during the Holocaust and Hitler, which is very real. It happened. But I think the real lesson to learn from that whole Holocaust is that it wasn't isolated to Hitler and the Holocaust experience with the Germans and the Jews and the Slavs and the Gypsies. It was a general human problem, that level of polarization, and that we can do it again. And that it probably has happened elsewhere similarly and perhaps even worse. That's the thing we need to understand, because only then can we actually say, well, then what is at the root cause of this type of thing, so that we can understand how we can grow out of it and resolve it and become unpolarized. That's how I sort of think of it.
Well, I've mentioned the on a number of shows in the past, the movie Forbidden Planet. I may even have talked about this with you, but the idea of a physical manifestation of a collective energetic force. And it occurred to me in the past that almost like Hitler was a being that came into our dimensional reality as a focused response to a certain energy, if you see what I mean. And this happens from time to time.
That's also got some support within an interpretation of quantum mechanics, because nothing, according to one interpretation of quantum mechanics, nothing can actually happen unless it acts in a state of what quantum mechanics people call a state of superposition. Meaning, if you're to get two phenomena to interact, their waveforms, their what you might call their quantum signatures, have to be compatible. The waves have to be able to interact. So from that perspective, if everything is based on that same concept of there being a wave function for everything, for every person, for every house, for every planet, for the whole universe, if there's a wave function for all these elements, then for that wave function to interact with another wave function so that you can have a merging of the two or mixing of the two, they have to be compatible, meaning every predator has a wave function that is compatible with every prey. So every perpetrator has a wave function that's somehow compatible with every victim. For every robbery victim, you have a robber. And their wave functions have to be compatible in some way, or from a quantum mechanical perspective, they will not mix. It will be like oil and water. You can see this in a very simple level of waves interacting, if you go to a piano and hit the middle C and the B, which is right next to middle C, and you'll hear two tones interacting among themselves, and they will cause a warble. It'll go wah, 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 wah. And what that is the two frequencies interacting in a way through processes that we call constructive and destructive interference to produce another frequency. So that wobble is in fact another frequency that's being caused by two separate frequencies. So that's how superpositions act. What they do is you have a bunch of frequencies combine, and they combine and mix it to produce some type of other frequency type of thing. And on a quantum mechanical level, we call that thing a wave packet. And it's from within that wave packet that you see a particle emerging. Now, if you have two wave packets that are sufficiently far apart, they don't really interact in a way that's significant. For example, if you hit middle C and then hit the highest B on the keyboard, well, there is some level of constructive and destructive interference that goes on, but it's nothing to write home about. There's no very significant interaction. It's nothing like you get when you have the V that's right next to the middle C interact, where you get a very noticeable wah, 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 wah. So what this is saying is that if Hitler came into this world and was the person that he was, which he was, he had to make the phenomenon that he had, which is a Germany that rose up and created World War II and the Holocaust, he had to do that within a supportive environment. He couldn't do that out of the blue. You just can't go into any old society and do that, meaning the territory had to be ready for him. The people had to be ready. The field had to be fertile for that type of thinking. And so that also alerts us to situations in which that type of thing could happen. We have to be ready for those types of things to emerge when the conditions are appropriate. So we can learn a lot from that perspective as well.
Well, Courtney, we've taken the latest Farsight project, as I say, the Adolf Hitler documentary, as a jumping off point for many, many interesting topics today. And I know it's a bit of a BBC cliche, but we could run and run with this. But one kind of thought that occurred to me sort of in closing for today is that I do remember reading many accounts from journalists and other people documenting the period that when Hitler died, or when it was, of course, there's a conspiracy theory that he never did, but when it was officially announced that he was dead, so many people described it like a spell being broken. And let's not forget that Hitler was raised up by many others around him. It wasn't just self-aggrandizement. He was Time magazine's Man of the Year in 1938, and not a lot of people know that. And it just caused me to reflect on, as an individual, you know, what I represent, what I manifest, and the people around me, and then the subgroups and the larger groups that I'm part of, you know, whether it's a race or a religion or a nation, and our role in all of this, and indeed the echoes from Hitler's reign. You know, we have neo-Nazis today. We have some of the same tendencies that Hitler manifested that have come back in echoes. You mentioned ISIS, for example.
Actually, this is a great way to sort of wrap it, because you're raising the ultimate question for this particular study. We wanted a study when we did a remote viewing psychological profile of a mass murderer. We wanted a study that would not sort of wrap it up and give some tidy answers to a mystery. We wanted a thinker piece, a piece that would cause people to think outside of the box and to cause people to ask questions that go way beyond just the results of the study. And that's what we got. And so in this particular interview, which was a really great interview, we actually went all over the board, but that was exactly the purpose of this study. Adolf Hitler, a remote viewing psychological perspective, a psychological profile of a mass murderer. Once you understand the psychology of Hitler, it raises all these other questions about who we are as individuals. So that was the whole purpose of it. And this interview is actually a perfect example of what the remote viewing project was supposed to do, which is to create this level of questioning about what is the fundamental nature of reality and why are we in a state of disarray that we're in as humans? Why do we live the way we live? And so, yeah, this was actually a perfect sort of entry into the bottom line meaning of this, of the whole project to begin with. You know, one thing I can say is that Farsight Institute, which is, as you know, farsight.org, farsight.org, like seeingfar.org, because we're a nonprofit. We are out there as a scientific group that really challenges everything that's mainstream about science and almost everything. Because the idea of sitting and saying everything is settled is the opposite of what we do. So if we look at polarization from a scientific perspective, we say we're on the level of change because change is fun. And others would say, oh no, well, Farsight does bad things because they're causing us to be uncomfortable. And they would want the lack of change. And so neither one is right, but in the absence of a desire for stability and long-term constancy versus constant change, in the absence of both of those elements, you wouldn't have growth in the society because there is value in constancy, but there's also value in change. But you don't want to be an anarchist like Wagner, Richard Wagner, who wanted constant revolution through all of existence. You want something good to evolve out of it, even if the good is not permanent, but always is in a state of evolving. And so this Hitler documentary that we just did, really leaves the idea of there being a simple, tidy answer to everything. And it opens up the possibility of thinking, wow, this is a really complex reality that we live in. Really, really, really complex. And Adolf Hitler's personality may not be due just to him being an evil person, but also the idea of childhood abuse, and also the idea of like maybe even a Darth Vader type personality who he might have been beforehand, and the idea there could have been worse Holocausts on other planets. I mean, it raises all types of questions. And ultimately you come back to, who the heck are we? Why are we like this?
Just briefly, I mean, if there is one life and or however you want to phrase it, consciousness is a ground of being, then whoever or whatever Hitler was, that's part of you and me. And I'm part of you, you're part of me, Hitler's part of us, and we're part of him.
Actually, that's very important. From a quantum mechanical perspective, nothing can interact with anything else unless this waveforms actually are in some overlap, some state of superposition where you get that overlap. So in a very real sense, the Hitler is part of all of us, and the victims, the Jewish victims, the Gypsy victims, the Slav victims, they're part of us as well. It's not like they're separate from us and they really don't relate to us and we can just sort of say that was bad, it should not have happened, they should be imprisoned or killed, and that's it's not the reality. They're us. These waveforms have to overlap and somehow. So the victims, the Jewish victims, the Gypsy victims, the Slav victims, they were us. They are us. Hitler, the perpetrator, the Nazis, the SS, they were us. They're part of us. They're not separate from us. We are the ones who did that. And that stuff that happened in the Holocaust, it happened to us. And what remote viewing tells us is that time is an illusion. The perceptions happened across time. And the reason we don't see things in the past anymore is because they're out of sync from a frequency basis from us, but they still exist. That means that the Holocaust still happens. It's still there. All the victims are still there in the concentration camps being slaughtered. Hitler is still there. All of that's still there. And so what, from the remote viewing perspective, this tells us is that that is not them there then. This is us now, who we are. And we have to learn from that and grow out of that. And how we grow out of that is the big dilemma. The only thing I know for sure that this least from my perspective, that this project really helps me to understand is that we have not fundamentally changed that much from the days of the Holocaust. We're still a polarized species, and we still have the capability of destroying ourselves and millions of people. There is an added risk because we now have greater levels of technology than Hitler and the Nazis had back in the 1940s. So the potential for us to do greater damage, you know, more pain, more suffering, increases with each decade, but also think of it with each century. The biggest mistake I think humanity could make at this point would be to say, that was a really nasty thing that happened back in the 1940s. Thank God it's over and it won't happen again. That's the biggest mistake. I think Menachem Begin's comment, never again. You know, the reason for the creation of the State of Israel was a safe haven, so that could never happen again. I would like to expand that, and not to this will never again happen to Jews. I would like to expand that to say that happened to humans, and never again means never again for humans. And for that to happen, we cannot get to that if we keep isolating the experience to Germans in the past who did it to Jews in the past, those people over there. In order to say and actually have the never again really be a universal never again, we have to integrate the polarization. We have to accept that Hitler was us. He was a human. We're human. He wasn't like a German over there. He was a human like me, like you, like everybody else. And that the Jews were not like those people over there. They were us, me and you. So that type of integration has to occur in order for this type of thing to not happen again. And I do not think that's happened yet. I don't think the integration is anywhere close to being it. I think we're fully capable of killing more people. And so I think this is the really timely time for that Adolf Hitler documentary to come out, because it raises these very deeply, almost unsettling questions that we have to ask ourselves.
Well, Courtney, I really couldn't agree more. I'm going to throw out a historical nugget, actually, semi-ironically here, for those people who are saying, I can't believe they're winding the interview up without talking about Hitler 100% of the time. Hitler's sister was called Paula Hitler. No, this is not a joke. She survived Adolf, and she worked in a gift shop until her death in 1960. I bet you didn't all know that. Now, Courtney, you mentioned the documentary, of course, is called Adolf Hitler, a remote viewing psychological profile of a mass murder. That's available to buy or rent currently at farsight.org. Is there anything else you'd like to throw out there, maybe about future projects or whatever, just before we wind up for today?
Yeah, actually, we are a nonprofit, so we do not have any means of advertising. So when you go to the website, farsight.org, to find out more about the documentary, please sign up for our newsletter. It's a free email newsletter, and we never give the addresses out to anyone for any purpose. And we only send out a newsletter once a week, so there's no problem with spam. And it's the only way we have to tell people what we're doing, because we don't advertise for anything. So if you sign up for that newsletter, that really helps us let you know what's going on with Farsight. We are also the only group of its kind on the planet who uses these full-blown studies of full-blown studies of remote viewing, as it was done using military or military-derived methodologies that you can see anywhere. There's no like other place that you can see these things. But we use the absolute best remote viewers on the planet. So we have some new remote viewers that you'll be seeing. We have another project coming out on Martin Luther King, and that's very fascinating that you'll be seeing. We have some young viewers that have been training that have gotten to the point of being scary good, and so you'll be seeing more of that. But you can also look at some of our other projects, some of which are totally free, such as the Atlantis and the Giza, the Great Pyramid of Giza project. So you have a host of stuff to watch, and all of our, we have a ton of instructional information for those people who are interested in remote viewing itself. That's all free. So, including like a over 24-hour, lessons hosted by YouTube on the use of procedures, plus a printable text and the whole thing like that. The only thing I would sort of like to mention as a sort of a way to wrap this up is that I know the whole issue of Hitler and the Holocaust is extremely sensitive to many because of the horrors that occurred during the Holocaust. So nothing that I said here is meant to diminish that reality at all. What we're only trying to do is to understand how that reality could have happened in the first place by asking sort of the most profound questions, not just about an individual, but the whole, like Hitler himself, the perpetrator at the top, but, you know, the whole environment that could have created that and who that kind of a personality could have been before he was Hitler so that he could do the horrors that happened. Only by understanding these things can we really understand the nature of our existence that allows these types of things to happen in the first place, so that we can eventually get to a point where it's never again. And in my personal opinion, that never again moment won't happen by identifying groups and trying to destroy them. That never again happens moment will happen when the polarization that we have in the society diminishes and we start getting integration, where people stop hating other groups but start understanding them. And I only think that, I think in my own way of interpreting this study, that level of understanding only comes about when you realize that those other groups are us, that we're not separate from these other groups, but they are us.
Quite right, Courtney. What we fight, we become, and what we do to others, we do to ourselves. So thanks once again for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greg, it's been a great interview. You've asked some really profound questions. I've enjoyed it tremendously, and I want to thank you so much for asking me to be on the show and for having me.
You're welcome, Courtney.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is LegalizeFreedom.com. That's legalize-freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.